welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I've never been more enthusiastic about a lineup of new business titles. Creativity, public speaking, less is more. I feel certain once you start listening, you'll find recommendations for kids entering the workforce or colleagues hunting for solutions to challenges. Together, now, we'll be introduced to solid principles I suspect we'll want to employ each day. My guest today, Beth Macy, profiles an American business icon who took a stand on keeping American factories open. Her book is about personality and rethinking globalization. So let's get down to business with a varied and vibrant collection of titles worthy of your time investment. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. The New York Times bestseller Freakonomics was a landmark book, changing the way we viewed the world, exposing the hidden side of just about everything. Now authors Stephen Jay Levitt and Stephen Jay Dubner return with Think Like a Freak. These authors definitely have the creds that make their books worthy of your time. Levitt, a professor of economics at the University of Chicago, was awarded the John Bates Clark Medal, given to the most influential American economist under the age of 40. Dubner, who narrates, is an award-winning journalist and radio and TV personality. With their trademark blend of captivating storytelling and unconventional analysis, the authors take us inside their thought process and offer a blueprint for a new way to solve problems. The topics range from business to philanthropy, sports to politics, all with the goal of retraining your brain. Along the way, you'll learn the secrets of a Japanese hot dog eating champion, the reason an Australian doctor swallowed a batch of dangerous bacteria, and why Nigerian email scammers make a point of saying they're from Nigeria.
You know, the chance of becoming a hero is about 75%, which isn't bad, but wouldn't it be nice to jack up that number? Might there be a better way to think about this problem? What if you could outfox your opponent by thinking beyond the obvious? You know the keeper is optimizing between jumping right and left. But what if you kick neither right nor left? What if you do the silliest thing imaginable and kick into the dead center of the goal? Yes, that is where the keeper is standing now, but you're pretty sure he will vacate that spot as you begin your kick. Remember what the data say. Keepers jump left 57% of the time and right 41%, which means they stay in the center only 2 times out of 100. A leaping keeper may, of course, still stop a ball aimed at the center, but how often can that happen? If only you could see the data on all penalty kicks taken toward the center of the goal. Okay, we just happen to have that. A kick toward the center, as risky as it may appear, is 7 percentage points more likely to succeed than a kick to the corner. Are you willing to take the chance? Let's say you are. You trot toward the ball, plant your left foot, load up the right, and let it fly. You are instantaneously gripped by a bone-shaking roar. Goal! The crowd erupts in an orgasmic rush as you are buried beneath a mountain of teammates. This moment will last forever. The rest of your life will be one big happy party. Your children will grow up to be strong, prosperous, and kind. Congratulations. While a penalty kick aimed at the center of the goal is significantly more likely to succeed, only 17% of kicks are aimed there. Why so few? One reason is that, at first glance, aiming center looks like a terrible idea. Kicking the ball straight at the goalkeeper? That just seems unnatural, an obvious violation of common sense. But then, so did the idea of preventing a disease by injecting people with the very microbes that cause it. Furthermore, one advantage the kicker has on a penalty kick is mystery. The keeper doesn't know where he'll aim. If kickers did the same thing every time, their success rate would plummet. If they started going center more often, keepers would adapt. There's a third and important reason why more kickers don't aim center, especially in a high-stakes setting like the World Cup. but no soccer player in his right mind would ever admit it. It's the fear of shame. Imagine again, you are the player about to take that penalty kick. At this most turbulent moment, what is your true incentive? The answer might seem obvious. You want to score the goal to win the game for your team. If that's the case, the statistics plainly show that you should kick the ball dead center. But is winning the game your truest incentive? Picture yourself standing over the ball. You have just mentally committed to aiming for the center, but wait a minute. What if the goalkeeper doesn't dive? What if for some reason he stays at home and you kick the ball straight into his gut and he saves his country without even having to budge? How pathetic you will seem. Now, the keeper is the hero and you must move your family abroad to avoid assassination. So you reconsider. You think about going the traditional route toward a corner. If the keeper does guess correctly and stops the ball, well, you will have made a valiant effort, even if it was bested by a more valiant one. No, you won't become a hero, but nor will you have to flee the country.
We've just heard Think Like a Freak by Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner. Impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. Ryan Holiday bases his book, The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph, on this quote by Marcus Aurelius. We are stuck, stymied, frustrated, but it needn't be this way. There is a formula for success that's been followed by icons of history, from Ulysses S. Grant to John D. Rockefeller to Steve Jobs. A formula that facilitated their ability to turn obstacles into opportunities. Faced with impossible situations, they crafted astounding triumphs. The author, who narrates, shows us the way.
In the year 170, at night in his tent on the front lines of the war in Germania, Marcus Aurelius, the emperor of the Roman Empire, sat down to write. Or perhaps it was at dawn at the palace in Rome, where he stole a few seconds to himself during the games, ignoring the carnage on the floor of the Colosseum below. The exact location is not important. What matters is that this man, known today as the last of the five good emperors, sat down to write. Not to an audience or for publication, but to himself. For himself. And what he wrote is undoubtedly one of history's most effective formulas for overcoming every negative situation we may encounter in life. A formula for thriving not just in spite of what happens, but because of it. At that moment, he wrote only a paragraph. Only a little of it was original. Almost every thought could, in some form or another, be found in the writings of his mentors and idols. But in a scant 85 words, Marcus Aurelius so clearly defined and articulated a timeless idea that he eclipses the great names of those who came before him. Chrysippus, Zeno, Cleanthes, Ariston, Apollonius, Junius Rusticus, Epictetus, Seneca, Musonius Rufus. It is more than enough for us. As Marcus wrote, our actions may be impeded, but there can be no impeding our intentions or dispositions, because we can accommodate and adapt. The mind adapts and converts to its own purposes the obstacle to our acting. And then he concluded with powerful words destined for maxim. The impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. In Marcus's words are the secrets to an art known as turning obstacles upside down, to act with a reverse clause, so there's always a way out or another route to get where you need to go, so that setbacks or problems are always expected and never permanent, making certain that what impedes us can empower us. Coming from this particular man, these were not idle words. In his own reign of some 19 years, he would experience nearly constant war, a horrific plague, possible infidelity, an attempt at the throne by one of his closest allies, repeated and arduous travel across the empire, from Asia Minor to Syria, Egypt, Greece, and Austria, a rapidly depleting treasury, an incompetent and greedy stepbrother as co-emperor, and on and on and on. And from what we know, he truly saw each and every one of these obstacles as an opportunity to practice some virtue. Patience, courage, humility, resourcefulness, justice, creativity. The power he held never seemed to go to his head, neither did the stress or burden. He rarely rose to excess or anger, and never to hatred or bitterness. As Matthew Arnold, the essayist, remarked in 1863, in Marcus we find a man who held the highest and most powerful station in the world, and the universal verdict of the people around him was that he proved himself worthy of it. It turns out that the wisdom of that short passage from Marcus Aurelius can be found in others as well, men and women who followed it like he did. In fact, it is a remarkable constant down through the ages. One can trace the thread from those days in the decline and fall of the Roman Empire to the creative outpourings of the Renaissance to the breakthrough of the Enlightenment. It's seen starkly in the pioneer spirit of the American West, the perseverance of the Union cause during the Civil War, and the bustle of the Industrial Revolution. It appeared again in the brave spirit of the leaders of the Civil Rights Movement and stood tall in the prison camps of Vietnam. And today it surges in the DNA of the entrepreneurs of the Silicon Valley. This philosophical approach is the driving force of self-made men and the succor to those in positions with great responsibility or great trouble. On the battlefield or in the boardroom, across oceans and many centuries, members of every group, gender, class, and cause in business have had to confront obstacles and struggle to overcome them, learning to turn those obstacles upside down. That struggle is the one constant in all of their lives. Knowingly or not, each individual was part of an ancient tradition, employing it to navigate the timeless terrain of opportunities and difficulties, trial and triumph. We are the rightful heirs to this tradition. It's our birthright. Whatever we face, we have a choice. Will we be blocked by obstacles, or will we advance through and over them? We might not be emperors, but the world is still constantly testing us. It asks, are you worthy? Can you get past the things that will inevitably fall in your way? Will you stand up and show us what you're made of? Plenty of people have answered this question in the affirmative, and a rarer breed still has shown that they not only have what it takes, but thrive and rally at every such challenge, and that the challenge makes them better than if they never faced the adversity at all. Now it's your turn to see if you're one of them, if you'll join their company. This book will show you the way.
We've just heard The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. Macy writes about underdogs and outsiders. She is a journalist for the Roanoke Times, where her reporting has won more than a dozen national awards, including a Nieman Fellowship for Journalism at Harvard. Today we'll speak with Beth about her new title, Factory Man, how one furniture maker battled offshoring, stayed local, and helped save an American town. Welcome, Beth, and thanks so much for joining us today on the Book Report.
Thanks for having me.
You set out to write a book that looks at globalization from a very different perspective, from the ground up. Explain that.
So I've been a longtime reporter for the Roanoke Times, and I'm not a business writer at all, but I'd watched over the last 15 years my business reporter colleagues cover one factory closing after another, after another, after another. All in all, 19,000 jobs went away in this one county alone, Henry County, Virginia, which has now had the highest unemployment rate in the state for over a decade. And I set out to do kind of an aftermath series to explain, like, what happened to all those people that lost their jobs? Half the workforce went away due to offshoring and its ripple effects. And in the course of sort of setting out to try to figure out what those stories would look like, I just happened to hear that 70 miles away, still in our, you know, region of coverage, there was one furniture maker that had managed to buck this trend, and he was really an outlier in the industry. His name was John Bassett III. He was no longer at Bassett because of a family feud. That made my little story spidey sense go up. And the other thing that made my spidey sense go up was he had taken on China in the Court of International Trade, and he had won his case. And he had used the money that he had won, the duty money that he had won, and pumped it back into his factory and kept these 700 jobs in Galax, Virginia going. And that furthermore, he said, and that he was a real character also intrigued me, that he said things like, I can't say this word on the radio, so I won't, but he said things like, the expletive Chinese communists weren't going to tell me how to make furniture. And just as a storyteller, it felt like, you know, gold to be able to have this great character, sort of larger than life rule breaker, who cares about, who's a multimillionaire, who cares about the generations of workers who have made his family rich. And that also you could tell the story of what had happened in the last 15 years in this region with all these furniture factory closings and what had happened to those people. So it just seemed to me to be a big story that deserved to have a book.
Right. So give us a little background on the Bassett family.
So Bassett Furniture Industry started in 1902 in family-owned land that, you know, never got incorporated. It was a company town called Bassett. And after the Civil War, they were sort of cash poor and property rich. And J.D. Bassett Sr., who is John, the main character's grandfather, started out as a lumberman, and a sawmiller. He started a little sawmilling operation, and then he talked the railroad into, they were building a line in the region. He talked them into going through his land so he could sell them the lumber for the ties. I mean, he's very kind of, you know, looking ahead at what's the next entrepreneurial activity. And then after a railroad line was established, he used the railroad to send his lumber up to the furniture factories in Michigan and New York. And his very clever wife said, well, why don't we make the furniture here? We've got all these people that need work. We could build a town to house them in. And that was just what they did. They basically, you know, in quotes, stole furniture making from Michigan and New York because they had cheaper labor, people eager to join the cash economy as the Industrial Revolution finally arrives in this rural Virginia, in these foothills. And they had free trees because they had thousands of acres of land. And they turned it into, eventually, the largest wood furniture maker in the world.
And then the Asians, specifically the Chinese, stole the furniture making from that area. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. And there's some real interesting characters in that story, too. I talk a lot about this man who was Chinese. He was educated at the Wharton School. He was the first Asian furniture maker to really take the Americans to the mat. He started out with a company in Hong Kong, and then he moved to Taiwan. And then once China opened up, he was the first to kind of figure out how to capitalize on this new exporting scene and really, you know, pose a threat. And his name was Larry Moe. But the difference, as John Bassett pointed, you could just say, well, the Chinese did to them what Bassett did to Michigan and New York. And the difference in the case of the factories that that John Bassett targeted with the anti-dumping petition was that they were being subsidized by the government. It wasn't very transparent. They were artificially underpricing, because of the subsidies, their furniture in a move to put the Americans out of business. And it was happening. You know, we said it wouldn't happen. A lot of people, whether it was being debated to let China into the WTO, thought it would be a win-win. They said, oh, that won't cause job loss because we'll be exporting more goods to the emerging middle class in China. But it really didn't happen because of these practices of dumping and of government subsidies and of artificially lowered currency.
Right. I mean, there was a great statistic in the book. You say between 1997 and 2000, Bassett Furniture went from operating 42 factories to 14. And then from 2000 to 2002, furniture imports from China jumped 121%.
It was incredible. I mean, and then the whole country, we lost 5 to 6 million jobs between 2001 and 2012. And at the same time, China gained 10 million manufacturing jobs. I mean, when the people moved, when China really opened up for business, first in southern China, Dongguan, it was the largest migration in human history.
We're speaking with Beth Macy on the Book Report. Tell us what happened when JB3 went to Washington.
First, he had to gather a majority of his industry, and it was almost too late. You can't file one of these petitions at the Department of Commerce unless you have 51% of your industry signed on. So he had to beg, badger, you know, bully some people into joining the coalition, because most of them were already importing themselves, and they realized if the duties got enacted, they'd have to pay more, so they'd be like shooting themselves in the foot. But they still had some domestic manufacturing, and he talked people into it by a variety of means. But you can see, like, the senators have never seen, like, somebody come and testify before them like that. You know? It was very simple, very folksy, and I would say dumb like a fox, because it was right on. You know, he got their attention, and as he told me later, he goes, you got to give them something to remember you by. You know? And he always does. He always gives us some little nugget to remember him by.
How long did it take you to research this book?
Well, I started writing the series in late 2011. It ran in early 2012. I quit my job for a year that summer and took a year. I actually had 11 months to write the first draft. And, you know, and then I kept piecing at it. I'd say at least 2 years off and on, but definitely 1 year just working full on this.
Are you already working on a new book?
I have a new book that word one has not been written, but I sold it to Little Brown. I sold the proposal to Little Brown a couple months ago, and I'm really excited about that because I don't have to go learn a whole thing that I don't know anything about. I get to really kind of fall into a story. I mean, I still have a lot to learn, but it's very different from this, but it's also from the same region, so I won't have to go too far afield to do my reporting.
Yeah. All right. Well, I have to say I really did enjoy the book and I learned so much. I'm going to be very cognizant of where my furniture comes from in the future. Thank you so much, Beth.
Really appreciate it, Elaine. Really nice to talk to you.
All righty. Bye now. And now let's listen to a sampling of Factory Man, how one furniture maker battled offshoring, stayed local, and helped save an American town, performed by Kristen Culby.
It was cold inside the factory where Bassett finally met with businessman and Communist Party official He Yunfeng in northern China in November 2002. The worker's breath froze in little puffs of vapor. The Chinese furniture magnate looked him in the damn eye, Bassett recalled. Then he said something that raised the hair on the back of the Virginian's neck. He Yunfeng would be happy to provide Bassett with the dressers at a fraction of what they cost to make, a feat Bassett knew would not be possible without Chinese government subsidies. All Bassett had to do in return, He Yunfeng said, was close his own factories. Close his factories? John Bassett pictured the whole lot of his hard-charging forebears turning en masse in their graves. He thought of his 1,730 workers, plain-spoken mountain types, many of whom had followed their parents and grandparents into the factories, standing in unemployment lines instead of assembly lines. He thought of the smokestacks that for a century had borne his family's name and of the legacy he wanted to leave his kids. Back at home, he felt alone in the industry, with only his two sons and his scrappy little factories. He was the last American furniture maker willing to raise hell about what was happening. If he could prove the Chinese were selling the product below the cost of the materials, if he could prove their factories were buoyed by communist government subsidies in an illegal price dump designed to drive American companies out of business, then his company just might survive. If he could convince a majority of his industry to join him in persuading the U.S. Department of Commerce and the U.S. International Trade Commission of the truth, maybe the entire industry could be saved. But those were big ifs, with potentially huge pitfalls. Surely he would be scorned by both his longtime customers and his competitors. He'd be ridiculed by the handful of families that had ruled the $50 billion industry, as well as some members of his own family, who were too busy closing down factories and cashing their checks to protect their furniture-making legacy. He'd be ostracized for trying to stop the flood of furniture jobs from America, for striking back against the one percenters who were about to move damn near all their plants to Asia and tear the heart out of the Blue Ridge region he loved. From the taverns of Virginia to the halls of power in Washington, D.C., from the factory floor to the back roads of Liaoning, China, where he would uncover a great lie at the heart of globalization, John Bassett was going to war. Part 1. 1. The tip-off. What were all them little people doing at work today? Bassett Furniture Line Worker, on the presence of Taiwanese factory managers. Once in a reporter's career, if one is very lucky, a person like John D. Bassett III comes along. JB3 is inspirational. He's brash. He's a sawdust-covered good old boy from rural Virginia. A larger-than-life rule-breaker who for more than a decade has stood almost single-handedly against the outflow of furniture jobs from America. When they heard I was writing a book about globalization with JB3 as a main character. Over the course of researching this book, over the course of hearing his many lectures, and listening to him evade my questions by telling me the same stories over and over, there were times that I agreed. I first heard about him in Rocky Mount, Virginia, about half an hour from my home in Roanoke, while eating breakfast with my neighbor and good friend Joel Shepherd. Joel owns Virginia Furniture Market, a Rocky Mount retail establishment that began thriving at the same time the import boom hit.
That was Factory Man by Beth Macy. From GQ's Nerd of the Year to one of Time's most influential people in the world, Biz Stone represents different things to different people. But to all, he's the creative, funny, charmingly positive, and remarkably savvy co-founder of Twitter. Now, in Things a Little Bird Told Me, Confessions of the Creative Mind, Biz tells pivotal and personal stories from his early life and careers at Google and Twitter, sharing his knowledge about the nature and importance of ingenuity today. In Biz's world, opportunity can be manufactured. Great work comes from abandoning a linear way of thinking. Creativity never runs out. And empathy is core to personal and global success. Jonathan Davis narrates.
Genius Biz claimed to be building inventions with infinite resources and a world-class team of scientists at his headquarters, naturally titled Genius Labs. One of my posts in July of 2002 read, "The scale model of a Japanese superjet that is supposed to be able to fly twice as fast as the Concorde crashed during the test flight. I may have to sign various paperwork that will flow millions into further development of hybrid air transit." Real-life Biz was not investing in hybrid air transit. I did, however, manage to land a job as a web specialist at Wellesley College. My girlfriend Livia found a job, too. We rented a place near campus so I could walk to work. It wasn't so much an apartment as the attic of a house. But at least it wasn't my mother's basement. My alter ego, Genius Biz, meanwhile, continued to exude confidence, gaining more and more of a following. He was Buddy Love to my Professor Kelp. But as I sustained this charade, something started to happen. My posts weren't just wacky anymore. Some of the thoughts weren't in the character of a mad scientist. They were my own. As I continued to write about the web and think about how it might evolve, I started hitting on ideas that I would one day incorporate into my work. In September of 2003, I posted, "My RSS reader, a syndicated newsfeed, is set to 255 characters. Maybe 255 is a new blog standard? Seems limiting, but if people are going to read many blogs a day on iPods and cell phones, maybe it's a good standard." Little did I know how ideas like this, which seemed incidental at the time, would one day change the world. And I say this with all the humble understatement of a self-described genius. Google acquired Evan Williams' company Blogger in early 2003. In the 4 years it had taken for blogging to evolve from a pastime of a few geeks into a household word, Ev and I had never met or even talked on the phone, but in the interim, I had interviewed him for an online magazine called Web Review, and I still had his email address. Now I worked up the confidence to contact him. I sent him an email congratulating him on the acquisition and saying, "I've always thought of myself as the missing seventh member of your team. If you ever think of hiring more people, let me know." It turned out that, unbeknownst to me, Ev had been following my blog, too. In the tech world, that made us practically blood brothers. Though he was surrounded by some of the best engineers in the world, he needed someone who really understood social media, someone who saw that it was about people, not just technology. And he thought I was the guy. He wrote back right away saying, "Do you want to work here?" I said, "Sure," and I thought it was a done deal. I had a new job on the West Coast. Easy peasy. I didn't know it at the time, but behind the scenes, Evan had to pull strings in order to hire me. Actually, they were more like ropes, or cables, the kind that hold up suspension bridges. Google had a reputation for hiring only people with computer science degrees preferably PhDs. They certainly didn't court college dropouts like me. Finally, the powers that be at Google begrudgingly agreed that Wayne Rosing, then Google's senior VP of engineering, would talk to me on the phone. The day of the call, I sat in my attic apartment staring at the angular white Radio Shack phone I'd had since I was a kid. It had a cord. It was practically a collector's item. I'd never interviewed for a job before, and nobody had prepped me for this. Although I naively assumed that I already had the job, I at least understood that talking to Wayne Rosing was a big deal for someone in my position. I was nervous that I'd mess it up, and with good cause. A few days earlier, a woman from the Human Resources Department had called me, and I'd joked around with her. When she asked me if I had a college degree, I told her I didn't, but that I'd seen an ad on TV for where to get one.
That was a sampling of Things a Little Bird Told Me by Biz Stone. Stress Test, Reflections on Financial Crises, was written by Timothy Geithner, former Secretary of the U.S. Treasury. His book has been called the definitive account of the efforts to save the U.S. economy from collapse in the wake of the worst global financial crisis since the Great Depression. On January 26, 2009, during the depth of the financial crisis and having just completed 5 years as president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Geithner was sworn in by President Obama as the 75th Treasury Secretary. Now, in a strikingly candid, historically illuminating memoir, Geithner takes readers behind the scenes during the darkest moments of the crisis. Swift, decisive, and creative action was required to avert a second Great Depression. But policymakers faced a fog of uncertainty with no good options and the risk of catastrophic outcomes. Geithner, who narrates, discusses the most controversial moments of his tenures at New York's Federal Reserve Bank and at the Treasury, including the harrowing weekend Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, the AIG bonuses controversies, and the lingering aftershocks of the crisis, including high unemployment, fiscal battles, and Europe's repeated flirtations with the economic abyss.
We had slowed the post-Lehman panic, but the financial system was still frozen. Banks that had overextended themselves during the boom were now in defensive retreats, hoarding cash, depriving businesses of financial oxygen. There was virtually no private credit available for ordinary borrowers who wanted to finance a new car or a college education, much less a new home. We had slipped into a vicious cycle as the financial earthquake began to ripple through the broader economy. As laid-off workers and other nervous consumers spent less, businesses were laying off more workers and investing less, prompting families and businesses to cut back even more. The crippled financial system was making the recession worse, while the deepening recession was making the financial system worse. Wall Street and Main Street were going down together. I had recently started reading Liaquat Ahmed's Lords of Finance, a history of the policymakers whose mistakes helped create and prolong the Great Depression. But I had put it down after a few chapters. It was too scary. The president knew he couldn't fix the broader economy without fixing the financial system. Banks are like the economy's circulatory system, as vital to its everyday functioning as the power grid. No economy can grow without a financial system that works, safeguarding the savings of individuals, moving money where it's needed, helping families and businesses invest in their futures. And ours was still a mess. "Now that I'm official, I can tell you how bad it really is," I said. "For starters," I told the president, "we still had 5 financial bombs to defuse." By bombs, I meant huge, far-flung, over-leveraged institutions whose failure could spark the kind of global panic the Lehman bankruptcy had sparked in the fall. I listed them: Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG, Citigroup, and Bank of America. They were all much larger than Lehman. All 5 had received major infusions of government cash to save them from failure. AIG had been rescued 3 times in 4 months, but they were all in trouble again, and we needed to make sure they didn't explode. Not to protect them from the consequences of their mistakes, but to prevent another messy failure from ravaging the rest of the economy. The politics would be awful. People hated the idea of government bailouts for mismanaged financial behemoths. But if their creditors or the markets in general lost confidence that any of them could meet their obligations, we'd be looking at a worldwide financial meltdown and a much deeper economic crisis. Fannie and Freddie, the Washington-based housing giants that backed most U.S. mortgages, needed the most help. They were quickly burning through nearly $200 billion in taxpayer aid, and without another $200 billion or so, the equivalent of more than 3 years' worth of Federal Education Department spending, they risked catastrophic defaults. Even a modest increase in that risk would push mortgage rates higher and home prices lower, intensifying the recession. AIG was the closest to exploding and the most egregious financial basket case. But while the century-old insurer had become a three-letter symbol of excessive risk, AIG also had tens of millions of innocent policyholders and pensioners who depended on it, plus tens of thousands of derivatives contracts with businesses around the world. A default on its debts, or even a downgrade of its credit rating, would reignite the panic.
That was Stress Test by Timothy Geithner. Ed Catmull, co-founder of Pixar Animation Studios, has just written Creativity, Inc., Overcoming the Unseen Forces That Stand in the Way of True Inspiration. Ed believes creativity isn't strictly a well of ideas, but an alchemy of people. George Lucas had this to say about the title. In Creativity, Inc., Ed reveals, with common sense and honesty, examples of how not to get in your own way and how to realize a creative coalescence of art, business, and innovation. Creativity, Inc. is a book for managers who want to lead their employees to new heights, a manual for anyone who strives for originality, and the first ever all-access trip into the nerve center of Pixar, into the meetings, postmortems, and brain trust sessions where some of the most successful films in history were made. It is, at heart, a book about how to build a creative culture. Peter Altshuler narrates.
On November 22, 1995, Toy Story debuted in America's theaters and became the largest Thanksgiving opening in history. Critics heralded it as inventive time, brilliant and exultantly witty, the New York Times, and visionary, Chicago Sun-Times. To find a movie worthy of comparison, wrote the Washington Post, one had to go back to 1939, to The Wizard of Oz. The making of Toy Story, the first feature film to be animated entirely on a computer, had required every ounce of our tenacity, artistry, technical wizardry, and endurance. The 100 or so men and women who produced it had weathered countless ups and downs as well as the ever-present hair-raising knowledge that our survival depended on this 80-minute experiment. For 5 straight years, we'd fought to do Toy Story our way. We'd resisted the advice of Disney executives who believed that since they'd had such success with musicals, we too should fill our movie with songs. We'd rebooted the story completely more than once, to make sure it rang true. We'd worked nights, weekends, and holidays, mostly without complaint. Despite being novice filmmakers at a fledgling studio in dire financial straits, we had put our faith in a simple idea. If we made something that we wanted to see, others would want to see it too. For so long, it felt like we had been pushing that rock up the hill, trying to do the impossible. There were plenty of moments when the future of Pixar was in doubt. Now we were suddenly being held up as an example of what could happen when artists trusted their guts. Toy Story went on to become the top-grossing film of the year and would earn $358 million worldwide. But it wasn't just the numbers that made us proud. Money, after all, is just one measure of a thriving company, and usually not the most meaningful one. No, what I found gratifying was what we'd created. Review after review focused on the film's moving plot line and its rich three-dimensional characters, only briefly mentioning, almost as an aside, that it had been made on a computer. While there was much innovation that enabled our work, we had not let the technology overwhelm our real purpose, making a great film. On a personal level, Toy Story represented the fulfillment of a goal I had pursued for more than two decades and had dreamed about since I was a boy. Growing up in the 1950s, I had yearned to be a Disney animator, but had no idea how to go about it. Instinctively, I realize now, I embraced computer graphics, then a new field, as a means of pursuing that dream. If I couldn't animate by hand, there had to be another way. In graduate school, I'd quietly set a goal of making the first computer-animated feature film, and I'd worked tirelessly for 20 years to accomplish it. Now, the goal that had been a driving force in my life had been reached, and there was an enormous sense of relief and exhilaration, at least at first. In the wake of Toy Story's release, we took the company public, raising the kind of money that would ensure our future as an independent production house, and began work on two new feature-length projects, A Bug's Life and Toy Story 2. Everything was going our way, and yet I felt adrift. In fulfilling a goal, I had lost some essential framework.
That was Creativity, Inc. by Ed Catmull with Amy Wallace. TED Talks have redefined the elements of successful presentations and become the gold standard for public speaking. TED and associated TEDx conferences are being viewed at a rate of 1.5 million times a day. The techniques used by top TED speakers are the same ones that will make any presentation more dynamic, fire up any team, and give anyone the confidence to overcome their fear of public speaking. Public speaking coach and author Carmine Gallo has broken down the top TED Talks and interviewed the most popular TED presenters, as well as top researchers in psychology and communications, to get their cutting-edge insights. The result is her new title, Talk Like TED, The 9 Public Speaking Secrets of the World's Top Minds. From unleashing the master within to sticking to the 18-minute rule, Gallo, who performs the book, provides a step-by-step method that makes it possible for anyone to create, design, and deliver a TED-style presentation that's engaging, persuasive, and memorable.
After analyzing more than 500 TED presentations, more than 150 hours, and speaking directly to successful TED speakers, I've discovered that the most popular TED presentations share 9 common elements. I've interviewed some of the world's leading neuroscientists, psychologists, and communication experts to gain a better understanding of why the principles that underlie these elements work as well as they do. Best of all, when you learn the secrets these communicators share, you can adopt them to stand out in your very next pitch or presentation. These are techniques I've used for years to coach CEOs, entrepreneurs, and leaders who have invented products or run companies that touch your life every day. While you may never speak at an actual TED conference, if you want to succeed in business, you'd better be able to deliver a TED-worthy presentation. It represents a bold, fresh, contemporary, and compelling style that will help you win over your audience. Ideas worth spreading. Richard Saul Wurman created the TED Conference in 1984 as a one-time event. 6 years later, it was reinvented as a four-day conference in Monterey, California. For $475, attendees could watch a variety of lectures on topics covering technology, education, and design. TED. Technology magazine publisher Chris Anderson purchased the conference in 2001 and relocated it to Long Beach, California in 2009. In 2014, the TED conference begins a run in Vancouver, Canada, reflecting its growing international appeal. Until 2005, TED was a once-a-year event. 4 days, 50 speakers, 18-minute presentations. In that year, Anderson added a sister conference called TED Global to reach an international audience. In 2009, the organization began granting licenses to third parties who could organize their own community-level TEDx events. Within 3 years, more than 16,000 talks have been delivered at TEDx events around the world. Today, there are 5 TEDx events organized every day in more than 130 countries. Despite the astonishing growth in the conference business, TED speakers were introduced to a much larger global audience through the launch of TED.com in June 2006. The site posted 6 talks to test the market. 6 months later, the site only had about 40 presentations, yet had attracted more than 3 million views. The world was, and still is clearly, hungry for great ideas presented in an engaging way. On November 13, 2012, TED.com presentations had reached 1 billion views, and now they're viewed at the rate of 1.5 million times per day. The videos are translated in up to 90 languages, and 17 new viewings of TED presentations start every second of every day. According to Chris Anderson, it used to be 800 people getting together once a year. Now it's about 1 million people a day watching TED Talks online. When we first put up a few of the talks as an experiment, we got such an impassioned response that we decided to flip the organization on its head and think of ourselves not so much as a conference, but as ideas worth spreading and building a big website around it. The conference is still the engine, but the website is the amplifier that takes the ideas to the world. The first 6 TED Talks posted online are considered classics among fans who affectionately call themselves TEDsters. The speakers included Al Gore, Sir Ken Robinson, and Tony Robbins. Some of these speakers used traditional presentation slides. Others did not. But they all delivered talks that were emotional, novel, and memorable. Today, TED has become such an influential platform. Famous actors and musicians make a beeline to the TED stage when they have ideas to share.
We've just heard Talk Like TED by Carmine Gallo. At times, we all feel the pressure to take on more than we can handle, to pack our schedules full and be all things to all people. We may think we're doing the right thing, but as Greg McKeown lays out in his new title, Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less, ultimately, this leads us to feel stressed out, overworked, and undersatisfied. Essentialism is a call to arms to stop the craziness and apply a structured discipline that will help to identify and foster what matters. The way of the essentialist isn't about getting more done in less time. It's about getting only the right things done. It's not a time management strategy or a productivity technique. It's a systematic discipline for discerning what is absolutely essential, then eliminating everything that's not, so we can make the highest possible contribution towards the things that really matter. The disciplined pursuit of less empowers us to reclaim control of our own choices about where to spend our time and energy, instead of giving others the implicit permission to choose for us. The author narrates.
To his great surprise, there were no negative repercussions to his experiment. His manager didn't chastise him. His colleagues didn't resent him. Quite the opposite, because he was left only with the projects that were meaningful to him and actually valuable to the company. They began to respect and value his work more than ever. His work became fulfilling again. His performance ratings went up, and he ended up with one of the largest bonuses of his entire career. In this example is the basic value proposition of essentialism. Only once you give yourself permission to stop trying to do it all, to stop saying yes to everyone, can you make your highest contribution towards the things that really matter. What about you? How many times have you reacted to a request by saying yes without really thinking about it? How many times have you resented committing to do something and wondered, why did I sign up for this? How often did you say yes simply to please, or to avoid trouble, or because yes had just become your default response? Now let me ask you this. Have you ever found yourself stretched too thin? Have you ever felt both overworked and underutilized? Have you ever found yourself majoring in minor activities? Do you ever feel busy but not productive? Like you're always in motion but never getting anywhere? If you answered yes to any of these, the way out is the way of the essentialist. The way of the essentialist. Dieter Rams was the lead designer at Braun for many years. He is driven by the idea that almost everything is noise. He believes very few things are essential. His job is to filter through that noise until he gets to the essence. For example, as a young 24-year-old at the company, he was asked to collaborate on a record player. The norm at the time was to cover the turntable in a solid wood lid, or even to incorporate the player into a piece of living room furniture. Instead, he and his team removed the clutter and designed a player with a clear plastic cover on the top and nothing more. It was the first time such a design had been used, and it was so revolutionary, people worried it might bankrupt the company because nobody would buy it. It took courage, as it always does, to eliminate the non-essential. By the 60s, this aesthetic started to gain traction. In time, it became the design every other record player followed. Dieter's design criteria can be summarized by a characteristically succinct principle, captured in just three German words, weniger, aber besser. The English translation is less, but better. A more fitting definition of essentialism would be hard to come by. The way of the essentialist is the relentless pursuit of less, but better. It doesn't mean occasionally giving a nod to the principle. It means pursuing it in a disciplined way. The way of the essentialist isn't about setting New Year's resolutions to say no more, or about pruning your inbox, or about mastering some new strategy in time management. It is about pausing constantly to ask, am I investing in the right activities? There are far more activities and opportunities in the world than we have time and resources to invest in. And although many of them may be good or even very good, the fact is that most are trivial and few are vital. The way of the essentialist involves learning to tell the difference, learning to filter through all those options and selecting only those that are truly essential.
We've just heard Essentialism by Greg McKeown. Readers, I found these books to be incredibly impactful, so much to take in, to process. As we all realize, continued success is based on an openness to change, a proclivity to embrace new thinking. Just one more reason why reading is so essential. For more titles from favorite genres, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.